Thanks, Arnbeck. It's indeed very nice to be back here, in particular for this program. You know, the four of you, George, Arnbeck, and you did a very nice job in, you know, setting up this program and bringing together a very nice group of people. So this talk will be about spin piles and stabilities in three-dimensional Kitaev models. So I would have to introduce to you what, you know, these three-dimensional Kitaev models and Kitaev spin liquids are, and then, you know, we can discuss these stabilities. So this work has been done in collaboration primarily with Maria Hermans, who was here for the conference and has been discussing some of this physics at the conference already. She will be coming back tomorrow and be here for the next 4 weeks. So she was really the driving force behind this project. We were joined by a graduate student on the way, and the physics of the spin piles and stabilities, you know, some of, you know, what I will be discussing today, you know, we did in collaboration with my colleague Achim Roche in Cologne. So to set the stage, let me show a phase diagram that many of you have seen in this program already. It's something, you know, reassembled from this review by Leon Jongbeck and others, which, you know, illustrates why we are having so many different talks in this program on a you know, variety of subjects. When we, you know, look at the interplay of correlations and spin orbit coupling and systems where these, you know, two things are basically accidentally you know, of the same size. So it's probably a good thing to locate where I am in this phase diagram. So I'll be discussing, you know, physics that, you know, will play, you know, out in here. So see that there is, you know, this line here, you know, which separates, you know, mod insulators for large correlations from, you know, metals or, you know, semi-metals or band insulators and topological insulators for low correlations. And this, you know, line bends down. Yeah. So I'll be in this part, you know, where spin orbit coupling actually assists, you know, the formation of a mod insulator. And the physics that I will be discussing will be, you know, developed from the perspective of strong coupling. So I will look at a microscopic model, you know, discussing the strong coupling limit. But the physics that I will be finding, you know, will be very similar actually to be what's on the other side. Yeah? So all the metallic states that are, you know, across, you know, the phase transitions to, you know, smaller correlations. So I will start here. So how can it happen that actually spin orbit coupling assists, you know, the formation of a mod insulator? Well, this is what happened in these J1/2 mod insulators that have been discussed, you know, extensively, of course, in this program. So let me quickly remind you how this works. You know, we take a system, for instance, iridium, put it in a D5 configuration. Yeah. So our D orbitals, you know, are filled with 5 electrons. And now you go through a sequence of, you know, considering the effects of the octahedral field, crystal field, which, you know, will split off, you know, two of these, you know, atomic levels, EG levels. Now we then consider the effect of spin orbit coupling, yeah, which will couple now the spin degree of freedom to the, you know, remaining orbital degree of freedom of this T to G orbital. And this will give us, you know, a filled J equals 3/2 band and a half-filled J1/2 band. And this half-filled J1/2 band has a considerably smaller, you know, bandwidth, you know, and as such, you know, the, you know, much smaller correlations of the 5D elements is sufficient to actually drive this system now into a mod insulator. And what you end up with is a mod insulator that has, you know, a Cramer's doublet as a local moment, which is exactly this spin orbit entangled J1/2. Now you might ask, you know, why should I care about this too much? So why are these systems interesting? Well, it all started with strontium iridate, which was the first J1/2, you know, mod insulator to be discussed. And, you know, that system is certainly very interesting as it exhibits, you know, magnetism very much like, you know, the cuprates. And there is a, you know, ongoing quest, you know, to see that we get this material into a superconducting state in similarity to, you know, what happens in the cuprates. So another main theme of these, you know, J1/2 mod insulators has been the search for exotic, you know, unconventional magnetism. Yeah? And, you know, this, of course, has been pioneered by George and Guignard in, you know, discussing that we might get, you know, this Kitaev-like magnetism in these systems. So that also puts me on track to, you know, study this system. So I will talk about Kitaev spin liquids, you know, that originate in systems where, you know, we expect this unconventional magnetism. I should probably also say that there's other materials that are interesting for, you know, these Kitaev-like interactions, which are not primarily interesting because of spin liquid physics, but because, you know, the Kitaev interaction induces, you know, interesting textures. So, you know, examples of that, you know, material class are probably, you know, the spiral iridium titanate, a triangular Heisenberg Kitaev system, you know, where you can get you know, Z2 vortex lattices or, you know, skirmion lattices for you know, varying coupling strengths. So that's also interesting. But here today, you know, we will go and really go after the Kitaev model. We will, you know, be interested in studying, you know, systems where, you know, very strong Kitaev-like exchange, you know, might drift the system into a spin liquid, and we are interested in understanding what these spin liquids are and, you know, what their instabilities are. Okay, so how is this all rooted in, you know, some experiment? Well, it's experimental systems that are, you know, popping up over the last few years have, you know, first been these systems, sodium iridate and alpha lithium iridate, in which the J1/2 moments form these hexagonal layers, so honeycomb layers, which of course is precisely, you know, what we have, you know, been first studying, you know, in the context of the Kitaev model. This is, you know, a spin 1/2 model on a honeycomb lattice. And of course, you know, we have heard many talks now about ruthenium trichloride, yeah, also, you know, generating such a lattice with these J1/2 moments. More recently, in the last 2 years, we have seen, you know, the advent of three-dimensional materials in the form of beta lithium iridate and gamma lithium iridate, which, you know, generate structures that are inherently not two-dimensional but three-dimensional of these J1/2 moments. And the feature that is, you know, the same in, you know, these two-dimensional and three-dimensional structures is that the lattice sides are still tricoordinated. So these are three-dimensional lattices which still have only three neighbors. Yeah? So that is, you know, if you think about that, it's actually not that easy to construct such a lattice. Yeah? So it was actually a revelation to see that in a material and then understand that these lattices can actually be built. Yeah? So they come by fancy names. You know, Hide Takagi has, you know, done some good branding. So, you know, this lattice structure is called the hyperhoneycomb, and this one is called the harmonic honeycomb. And these two are, you know, very much related, something that I will discuss probably later on. So the common feature of all these lattice structures is that they are tricoordinated lattice sites. So I can put a, you know, Kitaev-type exchange model onto this lattice structure. That is a model where, you know, the local moments interact with an interaction that is, you know, Ising-like, but where the Ising quantization axis, you know, goes along different directions in spin space as you walk into different directions in actual space, in the real space. Yeah? So, you know, going along the brown bond here, you know, you couple the Z components of the spins, going along the green bond, you know, you do the Y component of the spin, and the blue one is the X component. So this feature, you know, generates, you know, massive frustration, you know, in a much different sense, you know, than we are, you know, often studying in other contexts, like the pyrochlores or the hyperkagome, where geometric frustration arises just, you know, from, you know, the triangular structure of closed loops. So here, you know, this exchange frustration is different. You know, pointing along one of these, you know, three directions, you ought to, you know, automatically have no overlap, you know, with the other two. And so your spin has to somehow, you know, decide, you know, which, you know, direction it wants to choose. So even on the classical level, if you do this with, you know, O3 spins, you know, you will find spin like this. Yeah. So we are interested in the quantum model. And so this exchange frustration turns out to be extremely effective. You know, we get quantum spin liquids that, you know, show no ordering down to zero temperature. Yeah, so very effective system. Good. So these are the lattice structures that are realized in materials. And, you know, of course, I'm hoping that as, you know, our experimental friends are moving on, you know, we will see more and more of these materials show up. But at some point, we started to ask, you know, probably can, you know, leapfrog that and, you know, think ourselves as theorists, you know, what kind of structures actually exist, you know, that have, you know, this tricoordinated feature and are three-dimensional, yeah? And, you know, give us a way to discuss, you know, this Kitaev-like physics in very different lattice structures. And we will see that actually this is a route to very rich physics. Okay, so we started, you know, to ask, you know, how many such lattices exist. And, you know, over time, we started to find multiple of these, yeah? And, you know, what you see here is 9 different lattices that are all three-dimensional. You know, you look at actually photographs of, you know, these plastic models, you know, they start, you know, moving around. So these are fancy three-dimensional printed versions of these lattices. Oops. That you can look at and you know, make sure that they're indeed tricoordinated and three-dimensional, and see some of the features.
So, did you make them in a 3D printer?
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, Stephen brought something as an experimental, so I thought, you know, Sirius can also bring something to a talk. So here it is. So the first answer is, you know, first order approximation answer is there's many of these lattices, okay? And now we need to structure them. And one way of structuring these lattices is, you know, by looking very carefully at them, and actually seeing that the elementary loops, closed paths in the lattice that you can form, have different lengths in these different lattices. Yeah? So this is a sorting version. So you will find that there is lattices where the elementary loop length is 10, 9, or 8. And so these two guys up here, this is the hyper honeycomb. So that is the one that's actually passing around as one of these three lattices here. That is the one that is realized in lithium iridate, in beta lithium iridate, as a material. Our favorite one is this one here, hyperoctagon. That will be one that I will feature in the talk quite a bit. And I will also discuss, what happened with these other lattices. Okay, so let's get actually, this nomenclature straight. So let's learn a little bit about, how people classify, lattice structures. So here's how that works. This symbol is called Chaffee symbol. And it has, two entries. One is the polygonality, so that's the loop length, the elementary loop length. And the other one is the coordination number, or connectivity. Okay, so if we start filling these symbols, what we actually will find is that for very low numbers, we will generate the platonic solids. Yeah, so that's actually a fun thing. So 3-3, that's a tetrahedron. So we have triangular loops, and every side is tricoordinated. Yeah, loop 4, tricoordinated, it's a cubic lattice. Then you have this dodecahedron, and the other 5. So there's your 5 platonic solids, and then there is these 3 2-dimensional lattices, the honeycomb, which is loops of length 6, it's tricoordinate, the square lattice, loops of length 4, and the triangular lattice, which has loops of length 3, and connectivity 6. Okay, so that's, a start to a systematic approach of classifying these lattices. So now let's see, look further out, go to longer loops and longer, bigger coordination numbers. Well, everything else, that's bigger than what I just showed you is going to be 3-dimensional. Okay, so there's a ton of 3-dimensional lattices, for instance, here, 6, 4. So that's a 4-coordinated lattice with loops of length 6. That's a diamond lattice. So what we are going to be interested in are all these lattices. Yeah? So these lattices are the ones which are tricoordinate. Yeah? So tricoordinate lattices, that's the one that we are interested in studying in the context of these guitar F models. Okay, so now the question really is how many are there? Yeah? And that's the point where I really started to appreciate that universities have libraries and keep books from back in the day. Yeah? So in the mid-70s, Mr. Wells, wrote a book on 3-dimensional nets and polyhedra, where he reported his life's work in classifying these structures. Yeah, so that was cool, finding this book, because it told us immediately, how many crystals of the sort there are. So there's a distinction now that I make between crystals and nets. So a crystal is a structure where every side is tricoordinated and has 3 bonds in a 120-degree angle, and the bonds are all equal in size, equidistant. If these two things are broken, if you allow for arbitrary angles and you also allow long and short bonds, you get a structure that still has a unit, so that's very, very big, and which looks more like a net. Yeah? So these are what I call nets versus crystals. So in this counting, there's no crystal that has loop lengths 7. There's 4 that have loop lengths 8, 2 that have loop lengths 9, and 3 that have loop lengths 10. Okay? And these are exactly the ones that we have just seen. Yeah? So here they are all. Okay, so these are all the possibilities that exist, and that's it. Yeah? If you believe what Mr. Wells has done in the 70s, which I think is probably your best shot at this question, given that I wasn't able to create one of them in the first place. Yeah. Okay, so that's our manifold of lattice structures that we will be studying.
Can I ask you a question about this? Are each one of these associated with a unique space group or something?
Yeah. So here we go.
Okay.
So I can start making tables. We will see lots of tables now. Yeah. So here are the tables. So here are these 3-dimensional lattices, and as a reference, I also put the lattice 6-3, which is the honeycomb lattice. Then we started renaming these first two. The hyperoctagon, that's the 10^3a, or the mass literature is called K4 crystal. And the hyper honeycomb is this one. I probably should drop giving these things other names, because that's a very nice classification scheme. So what's given here in this table is not only the space group for all these lattices, so we can readily find that. It's also what's given here is, for us a very important number, and that's the number of sides in the unit cell. Yeah? So in the honeycomb, that's of course 2. And then in these structures in the hyper honeycomb, the hyper octagon, that's 4. And then there's lattice structures as well, which have 6, 8, 12, 16. So you can get into lots of trouble by looking at these structures that have many sides in the unit cell. And we can also very quickly identify whether these systems have inversion symmetry or not. What he realizes is that there is 3 structures that are chiral, that break inversion. It's going to play a minor role in what's going to come in the following. Good.
Okay, I'm going to ask the same question to Maria.
Go ahead.
So we knew about this book.
Very good.
Yeah, we didn't look at all of these structures.
You should have.
But did you find any real material that corresponds?
Yeah. So you know, don't steal my thunder, you know, right? So first of all, the way that we have chosen, you know, these structures here,
sure,
is that, you know, they have this 120 degree angle, and they're equal size bonds. So that's already a good thing, you know, in order to make it a, you know, real material. The next thing is, you know, that you can now go and start to backwards engineer, you know, materials. So that's you know, something that would have given you the hyperharmonic. We have done something very similar for this structure, you know, for H3B. You know, a lattice that will feature prominently later on. You can also do this. So that's actually very interesting, yeah. And you know, it immediately asks, you know, we can, you know, we also now professionals and, you know, producing VESTA files of these structures. You know, we can sort of design a material, look at it on computer, have no idea, you know, it's a stable material or not. So it requires density function calculations, you know, so it's most rudimentary sort, just telling whether these crystal structures are stable or not. So our very initial approaches to, you know, design this way a material, you know, were shut down by Rosa Valenti, who told us that none of these structures are really stable. And so it's probably there's a challenge out there, you know, for more materials-oriented people than I am to, you know, do exactly this exercise. So, you know, take, you know, these lattice structures, you know, of which you think, you know, they're interesting, and try to engineer a chemical composition around these structures that is stable. Yeah? So that's particularly interesting for, you know, H3B and 10^3a, which feature prominently in later on the talk. And which, you know, allow to do precisely, you know, what we have seen before. You know, they put an oxygen cage around the iridium sides, and then you can entire crystal of that. Yeah?
Excuse me. So what do you mean by the statement, none of these is stable? Because what you would have to check is all possible element combinations?
No. We do very specific ones. Yeah. So I'm getting ahead of myself. So what we try to do is the following. So we try to take this structure and make a lithium-type iridate out of it.
So we
said, you know, this site that we are discussing, the iridium site, we put oxygen cages around it, and there is some, you know, there's empty space, you know, between this, you know, which we fill, you know, symmetry group respecting this, you know, lithium sites. And we say, well, here it is. Yeah. And then, you know, that information we give to a density functional person and say, you know, is this structure, you know, stable? And the answer was,
yeah, but with sodium, yeah, it could be stable or with whatever.
Precisely. So now exactly. Now that's, you know, where I start losing my intuition. Yeah. You might put other atoms, you know, you might twin, you know, two of these lattice structures, you know, which you can sometimes do, and you know, do something more complicated, and that, you know, so that's certainly interesting question. Well, all of these tricoordinate lattices are stable in the sense that you can print these plastic models and stare at them, and you know, we have all these space groups, so you know, that's, you know, already information, you know, that might guide you in looking for such materials. But what is true is that, you know, what we are doing right now is probably more conceptual. In the sense that we are solving, you know, lots of these models and these different lattices, and we sort of provide, you know, motivation and guidance as to why actually three-dimensional quantized physics might be interesting. Yeah, because, you know, the reasons for that are, as I believe, you know, totally different from the two-dimensional version of this model. Okay, that's probably good to keep in mind. Okay, so let's, you know, talk about the quantized model. So what I will now do is I will place, you know, a very simple Hamiltonian onto these three-dimensional structures, like we have done in two dimensions. Yeah, so this Hamiltonian, which takes, you know, a spin 1/2, describing, for instance, a spin orbit entangled J 1/2 moment, and I will couple it along, you know, the three distinct bonds, you know, emanating from a vertex with, you know, three different types of Ising-like couplings, yeah, X, Y, or Z. And then, you know, what's also true is that for every one of these lattices that I've just shown you, there's one Gitaev coupling, you know, version only that respects all the symmetries. So it's there's a unique assignment of, you know, these three colorings up to cyclic permutations, which don't play a role, of these couplings. Okay?
Yeah.
Good. So I have these X, X, Y, Y, and Z, Z bonds.
You've done also something like a theorem guaranteeing that the Crown cell is the flux free sector?
That's, you know, you're getting ahead of, you know, we will address this in a second, okay? Okay, so this is a model, and you know, it's depicted for one of these three-dimensional lattices. And here is a phase diagram that is, you know, you should think of this as a generic phase diagram. So what I can now do is I can vary these three couplings, and I will be able to solve this model, you know, analytically for all these lattice structures that I've shown you. I can draw such a phase diagram on this plane, for instance, you know, where the sum of these three couplings is a constant. Yeah? So that's like, you know, what we have, you know, trained to do in the two-dimensional version. And generically, what we will find is, you know, a very similar phase diagram, like in two dimensions. So when, you know, one of these couplings is dominating over the other two, yeah, you know, then you get a gapped phase, yeah. And, you know, because, you know, the three are cyclical, changeable, you know, you get three of these gap phases. And, you know, around those point, you know, this red dot, you know, where the three couplings are equal in size, you get a gapless phase. And it will be interesting in describing the physics of this gapless phase. So what is not totally generic is actually, you know, these boundaries that you get this nice triangle, you know, for some of these lattices, you know, some of these, you know, slightly bent in. But that's, you know, that's sort of more a detail of the discussion to come. Okay? So generically, we will have something like this. You know, we will have extended gapless phase around the point of isotropic coupling, and the point of isotropic coupling is, you know, that you can now solve, you know, or, you know, solve, of course, anywhere in this phase there. So how do we solve, you know, such guitar? Well, so, you know.
So one of them, I want a metal. I mean, there's a finite density of states, or?
Yeah, so I will, yeah, we'll come to that point exactly. So, you know, I will classify for you what the Majorana metal is. Yeah? So I will discuss what the gapless spin liquid is by discussing with the Majorana. So how do we solve, you know, these three-dimensional guitar models? Well, we will follow precisely the same way that, you know, Alex and Kitar have used to, you know, solve the two-dimensional model, and which is a nice example of seeing, you know, that we fractionalize degrees of freedom in the spin model on the way. So we start, you know, with, you know, these vertices. Yeah, we have spin degrees of freedom, spin one halves. And the first step that we'll do is we will break up these spins, and we'll rewrite these spins in terms of four Majorana fermions. Okay? So that's, you know, something we can do on the operator level. So we introduce, you know, four Majorana operators, and then we recast, you know, the spin in terms of these four Majorana operators. So every spin now has become four operators. And the next big step is to regroup, you know, these operators in a slightly different way. So, you know, the color coding already suggests, you know, along this green bond, there's two green of these operators. And now I will join these two into a joint bond operator. And this joint bond operator will, you know, the operator has only two eigenvalues, and which I therefore can identify as a Z2 variable, and I will call this a Z2 gauge field. Yeah. So what I will have at the end of the day is, you know, well, one Majorana fermion, you know, this leftover degree of freedom on every side, and I will have a Z2 gauge field associated with every bond. Okay, and then I will be interested in solving that model. Okay, good. So how do I, you know, does this? Well, one has to distinguish now two things, you know, the physics of the gauge field and the physics of the Majoranas. So, quite generically, the Z2 gauge field, you know, is static in these Kitaev models, also in three dimensions. And also, you know, for these lattices, you know, what we typically find is that the ground state configuration of this gauge field, you know, there's a unique one, and then there is a gap, yeah, to the first excited state. The question is, you know, how do you find, you know, these, you know, ground state configurations of the Z2 gauge field? Well, so we do this via, you know, educated guesses, Monte Carlo sampling, or Lieb theorem. Okay, so what's Lieb theorem? Well, Lieb theorem is something we know, which has been alluded to by Stefan already. You know, so for the two-dimensional honeycomb lattice, you know, we don't have to discuss, you know, at length, you know, the physics of the gauge field, because we can use a theorem which says, you know, that the flux through, you know, the elementary loops in the honeycomb lattice has to be flux-free. That's the statement of Lieb's theorem. And, you know, it arises from, you know, certain lattice properties, so certain symmetries that the lattice has to fulfill. So now we can look at our list of different lattice structures and ask, you know, which one of these three-dimensional structures also fulfills these requirements. And the answer is, well, none of them but one. Yeah? So the lattice that we called A3B, yeah, the one that we can also, you know, turn into material, yeah, has also this feature that it is exactly solvable, so we can, you know, immediately go, you know, assign, you know, the Z2 gauge field to every loop and thereby to every bond, and then we are done, yeah, in discussing the gauge field. While for all the other lattices, we have to do other things, yeah. So the first thing is the educated guess. The education comes from Lieb's theorem. So, you know, the theorem tells us, you know, that for certain loop lengths, yeah, the flux is a zero, pi, for instance, and we will use that to, you know, check, you know, whether that, you know, if I were to apply Lieb's theorem to a particular lattice structure like this one, yeah, whether, you know, that will actually give me the ground state sector by, you know, looking at excitations and, you know, all kinds of, you know, symmetry allowed alternative ways of filling, you know, fluxes into the lattice.
Simon, can you restate again what's the requirement for to extend the Lieb's theorem to 3D?
Yeah, so the requirements are that you have certain mirror symmetries, yeah, in the lattice. Yeah, and so that's actually a very hard condition to meet. Yeah, and yeah, so only one of these lattices does this.
So there's no constraint on the loop length?
No. It actually works for arbitrary loop lengths. Yeah. So in two dimensions, for instance, we can apply Lieb's theorem also, you know, to the square octagon model, you know, which is 4 and 8 loops. You know, so that would work.
Can you say again what Lieb's theorem states with this?
Well, Lieb's theorem, so this particular theorem by Lieb, you know, states that if your lattice structure has particular mirror symmetries, you know, the ground state has to be in a certain flux sector. So for the honeycomb lattice, you know, the flux sector is flux free. So there, every loop has no flux going through it. Yeah. So once you know the flux through the loops, you also know the flux on the balls. You know? So then you have assigned your Z2K tree.
For free fermions.
Now, so the next thing is, you know, that it also makes statement, for instance, about this, you know, square octagon lattice. So if your loop length is divided by 4, yeah, then you actually have a pi flux. Yeah. Okay. So that also applies. So for instance, you know, this lattice A3B will have pi fluxes as in ground state. Yeah. So that's the statement. Yeah.
So does it also relate to the number to the commutator of the fluxes from two adjacent loops? So to the number of common sites.
Yeah. So I don't know exactly what you're asking, but probably you're asking this, you know. So what we also know is that, you know, elementary loops, you know, form minimal volumes. So for instance, here's a plot of this. Yeah. So in this lattice structure, which we, you know, this density A hyperoctagon lattice, you know, three loops form a closed volume. Yeah. So which means that the flux that goes in has to go out. Yeah. So it's a peculiar case where it's three loops through this. Yeah. You know, for the other lattices, it's a different number. It's 4, 6, you know, depending on which lattice.
Well, I actually mean that in the conical lattice, you have the flux operator on each placket, and they just commute with each other.
Oh, that's true here, too. That's true.
It's true only for this lattice.
No, no, that's true for all lattices. Well, that's true for all lattices. The flux is always a good corner.
When you say that there are the two lattices, here you're restricting yourself to coordination three, or is it?
No, so I'm restricted to myself to coordination three, so the lattices that I'm looking at. Yeah? So the answer is, you know, there's at least one, you know, this lattice, you know, where I can do Lieb's theorem, and which, you know, for the purists, you know, that's actually cool because it means that we can solve the model, you know, from A to B without doing any approximation. For the other lattices, we have to go through this, you know, discussion of the flux sector, and you might criticize us for that, you know, but of course, you know, that's backed up with certain numerics. Yeah, actually, the most elegant way of, you know, would be Monte Carlo sampling of the Z2 flux, similar to what, you know, Yoki Motoma has done for some of these lattices. Yeah.
But at this integrable exponent, the amount of lattice size you need to figure out the minimum flux sector should be not very big, right?
Well, so that's.
You have to go to. Yeah. To figure it out,
so yeah, so the answer is, you know, sometimes it can actually be very, very, very difficult. So for instance, you know, we have one lattice that has 12 sets of the unit cell, yeah, but the minimal flux configuration we already have 96. And then you're sort of dead, yeah, because you have, you know, 100 sites, and then you know, then this, you know, educated guessing, you know, no longer makes fun.
But it's a finite number beyond
the it's always a finite number, yeah.
It's not a thermodynamic limit you have to take to.
No, it's a finite number, but you know, the finite number might be unconveniently large. And that's where you really should do, you know, this number approach.
Well, when you say finite number, I mean, in principle, that's a property of the band, which is formed with the seven dynamical.
Yeah. So, but the statement for these lattices that we are considering, it's always a finite number.
Earlier, you made a comment that one of these lattices has ground state where you have pi flux.
That's true.
There's a single pi flux in it, or you have kind
no,
of
no, no, no. So for this lattice, you know, so you know, the common structure of all these lattices is that all loops have the same length, you know, and this length is either 6, 8, 9, or 10. Yep. Yeah. So in this lattice, all the loops have length 8. Actually, this lattice is, you know, it's one of the ones that's circulating around, the smallest one of them. Yeah. So you can actually check, you know, that whatever you do, you know, you will find a loop of length 8. All of these loops will have flux pi.
It doesn't give you this many possibilities to choose the UIJs to.
No.
Unique process.
So it's like, you know, whether it's zero flux or pi flux, you know, it will immediately set everything. Yeah, it's generically true. When you have set, you know, all the fluxes through the loops, you will have, you know, uniquely assigned, you know, the balls.
So you don't have to check for the whole sign, obviously, right? Because many of these configurations are related by cage symmetry. So the only thing you have to care about is the product, loop product of UIJ. So as long as those things are the same, they correspond to the same configuration. That's why the, you know, number of configuration is not like two to the some huge number. It's not like that. So.
Yeah. Good. So, Yeah, so this talk is not about the Z2 gate field. but you know, as you, you know, what is true is from the question that you're asking is, it's indeed the, it's the hardest part actually in the calculation, so we sort of, you know, put this under the rug. Okay, so let me remind you also that if you're in three spatial dimensions, so which you are for these GitHive models, you know, the gate theory will have a finite temperature phase transition. Yeah? So the gate field will freeze out at a finite temperature, as opposed to two spatial dimensions, where the gauge field fluctuates down to zero temperature and then takes down, you know, a ground state state. So this finite temperature transition has been very nicely demonstrated by Yuki Mutoma and his, you know, collaborators, and he has been discussing this at the conference very nicely. This is, you know, where our experimental friends should be, you know, wake up and say, whoa, finite temperature phase transition, that's actually good, because, you know, you would actually see this in the specific heat of the system. And, you know, you would see, you know, an experimental evidence of a gate theory. So it's actually very nice. Yeah, it's not that we have done this before anywhere. Yeah, so that's interesting. Unfortunately, the temperature scales associated with this finite temperature transition are very low, and also, you know, you're oftentimes not in this pure GitHive limit that I'm discussing here. So much about the gate theory. We will come back to the gate theory later on a little bit. So what are the Majoranas doing? Well, the Majoranas are not gapped. The Majoranas are itinerant. They're gapless. Yeah? So they're, you know, hopping on the lattice, and they form some gapless state, and that's, you know, some sort of Majorana metal. Okay, and what Majorana metal? That is, you know, what I would really like to discuss now. So here's again a table. Yeah, so let's look at this table. So again, you know, here are the lattice structures, and now I provide you with, you know, what the Majorana metal is on these different lattice structures. Okay. And I describe these systems by, you know, their nodal structure. Yeah? There's, you know, immediately a second column here which says, you know, how does this nodal structure, how does this metal change if I break time reversal symmetry? Yeah? If I, for instance, apply a magnetic field in my spin Hamiltonian. Yeah, that's, you know, what this table says. And then, you know, I wanted to talk about pilot instabilities. You know, some of these systems have a pilot instability and others don't. That's given in this last column. Okay, so, you know, this table I will show now many times in the talk. And now let's start, you know, looking at it and, you know, see what the different features are, you know, that are actually hidden in this table. So let me start with probably, you know, the simplest statement. You know, there is lattices where there actually is no Majorana metal. So there's no nodal structure. The system remains gapped. So you might be saying, well, that's actually the most interesting case because, you know, for the two-dimensional, you know, honeycomb model, you know, gapping out in the gapless phase with a magnetic field gives you a non-abelian topological phase, which is this gap phase here. Which is, of course, you know, fantastically interesting. Yeah, so you might be thinking that this is probably also interesting in these upper two cases, but it's not. Yeah, and this is, and we know this, you know, quite generally because we have a free Fermion Hamiltonian, which, you know, in this column here is in symmetry class BD1, and in this column where I break time reversal symmetry is in symmetry class D. Now, while I know that in two spatial dimensions I can get a non-trivial insulating state. Now, such a possibility is not existing in three spatial dimensions. That's something that I can immediately look up in Andreas's work. So I know that these things are gap, but they must be non-interesting, as in they're not topological.
How
do I break time reversal? I generically break time reversal, and I will discuss this in more detail later on, by applying a magnetic field in the 1-1-1 direction. Yeah, so because that's the 1-1-1 direction, is the direction that does, you know, the magic here to get me into this non-abelian topological phase. So I will generically look at that field direction. Nevertheless, you know, so in this case, you know, nothing interesting ever happens. Okay, good. So that was not interesting.
Thank you. It's
still
a Z2
spin decoy. Yeah. So you know, it's
more interesting.
You know, so there's different levels of interest, you know, that you might have. So let's say they're mildly interesting. Okay, let's go to what's more interesting. So here are, you know, three lattices that form Majorana metals with nodal lines. Okay, so, you know, importantly, 10^3b, which is a hyper honeycomb. So remember, that's the one that we have seen in an experiment. So this guy has two friends, you know, 10^3c and this H^3c, which are very similar in their physics. So okay, let's check, you know, how that actually works. Yeah. So here's the hyper honeycomb lattice. You know, here's a picture of it. Here's the GitHive model. Coloring gives you different types of couplings. As I said before, you know, this guy has four sites in the unit cell. So if you diagonalize your Majorana Hamiltonian, you'll get four bands, you know, four bands, four different colors. Okay, so now we look at this energy spectrum here. So it's given along some high symmetry path in the, you know, Brillouin zone of that system. And this is a Majorana spectrum. So what you're supposed to look at is this spectrum. But really, all the information that is relevant is the one above zero energy. So we sort of, you know, can drop out all the, you know, negative energy states. Yeah. So that's why the system is gapless. So there is, you know, these nodal points here, and you see that, you know, it's always, you know, occurring from two bands crossing exactly at that Fermi energy at zero. And now, if you plot in the entire Brillouin zone, you know, these nodal structures, so these gapless points, you know, that will give you this nodal line. Okay, so that's what's happening in this lattice. Okay, good. And it's, you know, to some extent generic. You know, there's two other lattices that will do the same story. Okay, back to the table. There's other lattice structures where we don't get nodal lines but Fermi surfaces. Yeah? So where we get entire surfaces, and those are really behaving like a conventional metal. So those are interesting. Okay, so you know, one example of that is lattice 10^3a. Okay, so let's take a look at that. Here it is. Yeah, it's one of the lattices that is, you know, moving around. You know, its high symmetry projection looks like a, you know, square octagon lattice, but it's really a three-dimensional lattice structure. Again, we calculate the band structure. Now we see the band structure is actually different at the Fermi energy. We still have, you know, four sites in the unit cell, so four bands. But the way the bands cross, you know, through zero energy, so the Fermi energy, there is only one band crossing. Yeah. So again, we can map out, you know, these gapless modes, and if you do so, you know, we get an entire Fermi surface. You know, one here, one here, one here. So there's two Fermi surfaces, you know, that are actually, you know, traced out at zero energy. Yeah, and they have some particular shape, and they're at one particular vector in the Brillouin zone, which we'll discuss in just a little bit.
Maybe I'm wrong, but it looks like particle hole symmetry is broken
here. No, no, no. There is particle hole symmetry. Yeah. So our system per default, because it's a Majorana system, has particle hole symmetry. So the Majorana is its own antiparticle. That's particle hole symmetry here. So you are saying this because you are confused about, you know, the energy spectrum above and below zero energy. Yeah, and, you know, it doesn't look right. We will come to that in just a second. Yeah. So it turns out that this, you know, system has different symmetries than what you're used to from particle holes, you know, symmetric fermionic systems. Yeah. That's exactly the crux. Yeah. That's the difference between these Majorana systems and conventional fermion systems.
Yeah. Question.
Okay. Good.
So as soon as I am in real space, it's okay. But when I go to k space, in principle, those excitations living at some gateway, I cannot call them Majorana.
Why not?
Well, they are not self-conjugating.
No, they are. So we will come, you know, to these questions of these symmetries in just a second. Yeah, and then
this is just a short question. Okay. When you refer to timers of symmetry for the spin liquid, does it always correspond to sublattice symmetry for the?
Exactly. So this is
all these lattices have sublattice symmetry.
So the sublattice symmetry, so the interplay of sublattice symmetry and time reversal symmetry is going to be the crux, you know, that stabilizes this Fermi surface. So bear with me for a minute, and then we discuss this, okay? So this is precise, you know, so you're precisely hitting the point, okay? So all of you are very good. Okay, so let's play a little bit with the structure. So if you, you know, change one of these coupling strengths, yeah, you know, this band structure will, you know, change, you know, the Fermi surface will disappear, you get a quadratic band touching, and you go into a gap phase. So that's a phase transition into a gap phase in the Keith Hive model. Okay, so and here's how it looks in terms of, you know, Fermi surfaces. So if you take the coupling, you know, away from the isotropic point, and you walk towards a phase transition into the gap phase, you know, the Fermi surfaces will shrink, and then you get this quadratic band touching, and out you are. And, you know, in the other direction, you know, they will flatten and, become degenerate at precisely at the decoupling point. So what we have established is a Z2 spin liquid with a, you know, Majorana Fermi surface, or if you recast this in the language of, you know, spins, you know, we have a spinon Fermi surface. It's actually pretty cool, yeah, because, you know, this model is exactly solvable. You know, it's probably the first exactly solvable model, you know, providing us with such a spinon Fermi surface beyond doubt. Yeah, so conceptually nice, and probably.
I think there was another one.
No, like Bhaskara.
Okay.
Tomorrow.
So let me write second. So it was, to my knowledge, it was the first part of my knowledge. Okay, I'm happy to learn this. Actually, I sent you an email asking, huh? You know, whether it's the first one or not. So now you're correcting me. Okay, good. Anyway, it's conceptually nice. You know, we have an exactly solvable model that, you know, gives us spin on Fermi surface. So that's no longer a, you know, pie in the sky construction. Interestingly, it happens in the context of a Z2 spin liquid and not a U1 spin liquid, where, you know, this is probably thought to be much more generic. How can we distinguish these things? Our experimental friends wake up, you know, by experimental signatures. Yeah? So you can measure correlation functions in these spin liquids, like in the two-dimensional Kitaev model, the spin-spin correlations decay exponentially. Ooh, bad place to look. But if you were to look for, you know, the bond energy correlation, so, you know, correlated like this, you would see a nice algebraic divergence in its Fourier transform, you know, reflecting the Majorana Fermi surface. Now, how we can actually measure these things, that's a more difficult question. But there is something very simple we can do. We can just measure the specific heat. So if we were to have a system that would, you know, generate an ideal Kitaev model, yeah, then we can very nicely now distinguish the following cases. So if we have, you know, what I just, you know, discussed, a Z2 spin liquid with a spin on Fermi surface, the specific heat will really go linear in temperature. Yeah? And that's very remarkable. Yeah? So this is really what a spin liquid is. You're in a Mott insulator, no charge fluctuations, still your specific heat looks like that of a metal. And that's because, you know, the spin-on degrees of freedom just mimic, you know, the metal. Okay?
Why do you want spin liquid to go to T-log model?
Whoa. So this is the Z2 spin liquid that I just discussed. Maybe contrast that from, you know, the one with a nodal line. Yeah? You know, in that case, it would have a T squared. And the U1 spin liquid in three dimensions, you know, picks up this additional log 1 over T. Yeah? So the divergence.
Here's U1 spin liquid. You have some of the spin now. Is it Dirac Fermi or from the surface? Or?
Yeah, so I take, you know, I'm saying if I take a U1 spin liquid with a spin on Fermi surface, you know, that would be
T.
Well, I think so. Okay, so we can discuss this.
This is still log. If you include the one loop correction, it's still log.
The log is interaction effects.
No, it's a spin off from a surface. You won't get, we have a whole damn dynamics.
Yeah, so this is why you get a loop correction in three dimensions. This is 2+1.
No, I see.
Not 2+1. 2+1 is 3. Yeah. That's the difference.
Yeah, also another question. So when you say spin off from a surface, so let's see, we'll carry. So
let's see,
we'll carry what spin? Wait, the spin
now
will carry what spin bond number?
No, it's spin 1/2.
No, but C is sort of spin synchrotron. That's R for beta gamma, that's a spin vector. So the C actually, which moves around in the entire system, is a spin synchrotron. So I don't see why you call it a spin now. Right? It has a way of introducing the Cs.
No, I think one should call them spin on.
System.
But it doesn't have a spin, that's true.
There's no
SU2 symmetry. There's no SU2
symmetry. Yeah, then you can carry some quantum number, right? So, like, carry some like atomic growth or something.
It carries entropy.
Good. So
it doesn't carry spin quantum.
Let me carry my point home. Okay, what I wanted to just say is this, you have all I wanted to say is, yeah, that we can distinguish now very nicely, you know, these nodal structures that you see in these, you know, Z2 spin liquids. Yeah, D squared versus T very easily, and you can also distinguish it from a different gate structure.
For spin 1/2, isn't
that
Z the operator as Z just 1 squared?
No. Oh, yeah. So that's, you know, probably written in a non-optimal way. So it's really.
It's a four-spin operator.
It's a four-spin operator.
Bond.
So it's a bond.
Like this one.
So. Yeah. So it's a bond energy correlation. Okay, good. So Leon is here. Now I can start with the non-trivial stuff. So let's ask, you know, why the Fermi surface is stable in some of these lattices and you know, non-stable in others. Yeah? So that's, you know, that's a principal question. And I will answer these questions, you know, several times now. The first one is, you know, that we will go through symmetries. Okay? So particle hole symmetry, yeah, in our spectrum translates into this. Yeah? So E of K is minus E of minus K. And now the more interesting symmetries are the sublattice symmetry, the time reversal symmetry, and inversion symmetry, which all in these Majorana systems get shifted by a vector k-naught. So what's k-naught? K-naught is the sublattice vector of your lattice. So what's that? Yeah. So the lattice structures that I'm discussing, yeah, are bipartite lattice structures. You know, they have, you know, loops of length 6, 8, or 10. Yeah, so I can, you know, color code, you know, my lattice in, you know, two sublattices. And I can see that in this particular structure, you know, that I'm discussing, actually, you know, going from one unit cell to another one by a, you know, lattice vector, I connect, you know, wrong sides. I, you know, connect a blue one with a white one. Yeah? So what that means actually that, you know, this is no longer, if I bipartite my lattice in this way, this is no longer a good lattice vector. So let's understand this in context of something simpler. If I go to the honeycomb lattice, you know, the honeycomb lattice, which is also a barbertite lattice, the lattice vectors do connect the same sublattice. So that's, you know, that's a lattice, you know, where this k-naught is going to be zero, as opposed to, for instance, the squirrel lattice, which of course is also a bipartite lattice. But, you know, if you, you know, do this, you know, blue and white thing, you double the unit cell of the squirrel lattice, and the original lattice vectors now no longer connect sublattices. So you have to actually indeed, you know, double, you know, these vectors in order to, you know, reconnect sublattices. And that will give you a finite k-naught, you know, a reciprocal lattice, you know, that is, you know, the translation vector between these sublattices. Yeah. So whenever your k-naught is non-zero, that's going to be interesting. And that's precisely the case for the systems where we find these Fermi surfaces. Okay? So remind yourself, so bipartite lattices, but the bipartite lattice structure is not commensurable with the elementary unit cell. You have to double the unit cell in order to do that. Okay. So on the level of, you know, looking at Hamiltonians, that gives you already a certain structure. So for the lattice structure like the honeycomb lattice, you know, you will get this 2x2 matrix that we all know from the Kitaev model. For the hyperhoneycomb lattice, a lattice, you know, which has this node line and which has no k-naught vector, you know, we will, you know, get a matrix that has, you know, block diagonal 2x2 parts that mimic precisely this physics. While if my k-naught is a finite value, yeah, I get a, you know, generic band Hamiltonian, and as such, you know, this is all my symmetry requires me to have. If I have time reversal symmetry, and this generic band Hamiltonian can, of course, you know, generate a metal.
Sorry. What's the difference between second and
third density? So the difference is, you know, the color coding of the zero. So this is, you know, this is a 4x4 matrix, where this zero, you know, is a block diagonal 2x2 matrix zero. While here there's only zeros on the diagonal. Yeah. So here, you know, this is a matrix which has four zeros on the diagonal, and all the others are off. Are non-zero, while here you have a 2x2, you know, zero in the upper left block and 2x2 zero in the lower right block.
You said they all are two sublattice structures, right?
They're all two sublattice structures, but
the
difference.
All put them
no.
In the block.
No, no. So that's again, it's a question of whether you have this kind out or not. So whether, you know, your sublattice structure, you know, has, you know, this unit cell doubling or not. Yeah. So that comes precisely from that. Yeah. Okay. Right. But yeah.
Can you please write
down
the time reversal acting manner? Can you
please explain? Yeah, we'll come. So the symmetry operation will come next slide. Yeah?
Is that T squared to the 1 or minus 1?
What's that?
Is that T squared to the 1 or minus 1?
That's one. Yeah? So, okay, so let me, you know, okay, probably this is too abstract, and let me give you a second way of discussing this, and this is exactly the spin pi instability, which is probably also a much more elegant way of discussing this. So now that we have a Fermi surface, yeah, we might ask, you know, what's the instability of the Fermi surface? You know, it's a generic question that we always ask in a fermionic system, which has a Mariano Fermi, which has a Fermi surface. In these systems, you know, we have to be a little more, you know, cautious because, you know, really we have Majoranas, you know, that form these Majorana Fermi surfaces, and we have to understand, you know, what happens. And what I will tell you is that the generic instability of these Fermi surfaces is a spin Piles instability. So something where the system, you know, spontaneously double its unit cell, and, you know, has the effect of, you know, destroying, you know, that Majorana Fermi surface. And what, you know, generates this doubling of the unit cell is an interaction between the Majoranas, yeah, which you can induce by, you know, adding additional interactions to your Hamiltonian. Okay. So first statement is, you know, if I look at my Majorana Fermi surfaces and I discuss everything in the language of the Majorana fermions, you know, then I have two Majorana Fermi surfaces, which are at, you know, plus k-naught over 2 and minus k-naught over 2. Yeah? So there's a perfect nesting between the two Fermi surfaces. Yeah? So that means, you know, that the energy at k is precisely the energy at k plus k-naught. So this guy and that guy can be shifted into each other by k-naught. Yeah? Good. And time reversal symmetry looks like this. Yeah? So it's very specific in these systems. Yeah? So I take, you know, a Majorana at the lattice side R. Yeah? And I will transform it into a Majorana, which is this pre vector, you know, where this k-naught now enters, you know, the sublattice vector. Of course, I can take two Majorana fermions and recast them in a complex fermion. Let's do that. Yeah? So I take two Majorana fermions now, and I recast them into a complex fermion. When I do this, yeah, my two Fermi surfaces become one. They fall on top of each other. Yeah? So I get just one Fermi surface. Yeah? And my energy relations look like this. Yeah? So the energy at k-naught over 2 plus k and the energy at k-naught over 2, so that's the vector pointing in the middle of this Fermi surface, minus k. It's the same, and time reversal symmetry in these complex fermion variables looks like this. Yeah? And now in this language, you know, I can discuss, you know, a very conventional BCS instability. Yeah, and that is what I will do.
Yeah, maybe, I'm just a bit confused by this K0. Is this because when you do Fourier transform, you keep the position of every site instead of keeping only position of the unit cell, center of mass of the unit cell?
Say that again? So I don't change, at this point, I'm not changing any position of sites. Yeah,
right.
Do this later.
But when you do a Fourier transform, because you have multiple sites per unit cell, right?
Mm-hmm.
You keep track of the position of every site when you do Fourier transform.
Yes. So I have to check now. So this sub j here is actually, you know, which one of the sites in the unit cell you are talking about. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4.
That's why you get the factor of K0.
That's why you get a factor.
I guess if you only keep the central mass position of the whole unit cell to do Fourier.
That's also true. Yeah. So it's just simple bracket.
So this is actually, I think this may give you some problem when you, for example, compute some topological index. Because that is a non-local transformation in K-space. It's not a single array transformation in K-space.
You
will change, for example, some winding number by 1/2 or something.
No. We will also do this later on, this exercise of calculating topological indices. Okay? So let's discuss a BCS instability.
K-naught is
So K-naught is a vector that can...
UDI K-naught.R is real or complex?
So that is generically real. It has to be real.
Because C is Majorana.
C is Majorana. Okay. So now let's actually change the perspective. Actually, now the discussion in the complex family is much simpler. Yeah? So you know, you look at this energy relation, and well, you know, that suggests, you know, that, you know, you should form a pairing term, which is, you know, f dagger k naught plus k and f dagger k naught over 2 minus k. Yeah? But then you realize, aha, you know, but this, you know, pairing term k is a finite momentum k naught. Yeah, so K0 is non-zero. Yeah, so I can only generate, you know, this kind of pairing term if I spontaneously break translational symmetry and I, you know, enlarge my unit cell. Or if I, you know, discuss this in a different case, in those lattice structures where K0 is zero, yeah, my Majorana Fermi surface would have a, you know, simple BCS instability that will, you know, destroy the Fermi surface. So that's the reason why on the lattices where K0 is sublattice vector is zero, like, you know, the hyperhonicon, you see a nodal line instead of a Fermi surface. You know, that's one way of saying this. Yeah, there you would have, you know, in pairing instability immediately, so it will never be stable. Okay.
When you're saying break translational symmetry, you mean just the two sublattices?
No, that
phases.
I will show you how that works in a second. Yeah. So then I'm going to show you this. Yeah? Okay. So now we write down our Majorana Feynman Hamiltonian. So the Majorana Feynman Hamiltonian that we write down now is one where I take the Kitaev coupling and I add, for instance, a Heisenberg term. Yeah. So the Heisenberg term will generate, you know, 4 Majorana interactions. And the precise form of this, yeah, you have to work out for your lattice structure. So this is all done for this hyperoctagon lattice, so tends to A, where I have these 4 Majoranas and a unit cell. And, you know, the symmetry allowed, you know, low energy things, you know, that don't change, you know, the Z2 gauge fields, so no Weissmann excitations, are exactly these types of forms. You know, there is a 4 Majorana term within the unit cell, and there's a 4 Majorana term where you take 3 Majoranas out of 1 unit cell and 1 Majorana out of, you know, the nearby unit cell.
So the Heisenberg terms do not induce any dynamics of the Z2.
They do.
Boxes?
They do.
But you project to them around.
So, yeah, so this is all done in the case of small Heisenberg interactions. So the Weissmann is gapped. Yeah, so introducing the Heisenberg exchange will do 2 things. It will give a dynamics to the Weissmann, so that will start to disperse. It's a longer static. But because it's gapped, you know, it will take a finite amount of that coupling for that thing to condense. We are not in that limit. We are still in the gapped regime. But what will immediately happen is that you induce also these Majorana interactions. Okay, so then, but, you know, now all depends on microscopic detail. We have no idea, you know, what the relative strength of these two terms is. So that's why we parameterize them by some angle. Okay. And we have, at this point, no good understanding of where we are. So we will determine for arbitrary different strengths of these two couplings now what happens. Yeah?
Simon, what happened to the pairing term?
Pairing?
There's a pairing term without the Heisenberg.
Oh, so again, so the pairing term without the Heisenberg, yeah, is what we will now, you know, we will now argue for. Yeah. So if K0 is zero, you know, you can generate it easily. And those are the situations where you don't have a Fermi surface. Yeah? So the lattices which don't have a Fermi surface, they have K0 equal to zero. For those lattices where K0 is, you know, finite, yeah, you want to create these pairing terms, but it comes at the expense of doubling the unit cell. Yeah? So your system will not spontaneously do this. Yeah, if there is, you know, the Kitaev model cannot do this. You have to, you know, put something on top of this, some, you know, energy term that will actually, you know, drive this, you know, energy balance, you know, that, you know, pairing actually is an energy gain. Yeah, so this is what we are doing right now. Okay, so we take this Majorana Hamiltonian, we rewrite it in the terms of the complex fermions, we give you four fermion terms, and I do this in a way that, you know, I get all the symmetry allowed terms, which are low energy. So, you know, there are certain terms like, you know, f dagger k, f dagger minus k, which are high energy terms because only one of the guys sits on the Fermi surface while the other one is not. Okay, so those cannot occur. Okay, and now I can write down, you know.
This is a, in a sense, a low energy, what you write.
This is low energy. This is low energy. Yeah.
Generically, I have a clear energy.
So this is low energy. Yeah, and now I do a BCS theory for this. Yeah, and now, you know, like it's very standard arguments now, yeah? Yeah? Okay, so I get a BCS theory that I apply, you know, so this is my original Kitaev Hamiltonian plus, you know, the pairing instability, and then there's an order parameter that we have to calculate, yeah? And we also know, because everything is expressed in terms of spinless fermions, we are, you know, generically discussing a P-wave superconductor, yeah? So, you know, we have an idea of, you know, how this temperature, you know, for instance, you know, will look like, okay? So it's exponentially suppressed. So here's that order parameter, yeah? As a function of this angle, you know, which, you know, goes through these couplings, yeah, and, you know, we can calculate that, yeah, along here, and, you know, we can also calculate the transition temperature, you know, get some phase diagram like this. Okay, so, and then the story is that, you know, depending on the relative strength of these two four Majorana coupling terms that are induced in some combination that we don't know from the Heisenberg exchange, you will get, you know, five different phases A, B, C, yeah, and they have these five different distributions of the order parameter, you know, on that Fermi surface. Okay, so all phases break translational symmetry. Yeah, so, you know, that is the statement that all of these phases are Pyle's phases that double the unit cell. Yeah, and then these first four, 1, 2, 3, 4, A to D, you know, they're actually breaking additional lattice symmetries. That's actually also very interesting. Yeah, so, you know, these are the scenario that we can have. But what I will be discussing mostly is, you know, this structure, that's phase E, which is, you know, the simplest one in the sense that it only breaks translational symmetry. And from the order parameter distribution, you know, you can already see that, you know, what you will form is, you know, a nodal structure that is now three lines. You know? So your Fermi surface collapses onto three nodal lines. So you go from one spin liquid with a Fermi surface, to a spin liquid with three nodal lines. Okay. Okay, so this is our phase E, you know, that breaks only translational symmetry. Here's our lattice structure. And so now you can ask, you know, how can you break translational symmetry and not break any other symmetry in this lattice? And there's only one way of doing this for a lattice, you know, which has four sides in the unit cell, and that's shown here. So along the high symmetry axis, this one-on-one direction, you will deform the lattice. So what you should, you know, keep track of are these four sides, the red, and the yellow one, which are along this 1-1-1 directions, neighboring sides. And what you will see is that when you deform, you know, they will go, so this is the undeformed case where we have equidistance, they will go to long, short, long, short. So that's a Pyle phase. You know? So what will happen is that the system, you know, will deform, you know, the lattice structure in such a way, and it will gain energy in that way. So this is the spin Pyle instability, yeah. So you break down your space grid, you know, the one, you know, which has these elongated and shortened bonds. And there's a direct signature of this in, you know, valence bond correlations. If you look along these directions, you know, they will pick up, you know, an oscillating term that is proportional to the order parameter.
Perhaps it's a semantics question, but Pyle's instability, the conventional one, in the dimensions higher than one, require a critical value of the coupling, while BCS does not.
Yeah.
So you easily go between the two, and I'm...
So the statement is exactly the other way around. Mm-hmm. So spin piles in one dimension, yeah, requires a critical coupling. Yeah. So if you take a spin piles chain, a spin chain, you know, it will take a finite coupling strength, you know, for, you know, dynamical fermions to you know, do the dimerization, you know, that, you know, has been studied in spin chains for ages. Yeah. So for yeah. So if your quantum phononic degree of freedom, it takes a finite coupling strength. Yeah. In one dimensions. Well, for the high dimensions, it's exact opposite. Yeah, so here is an example of where it takes precisely.
For spin 1/2 chain, it's infinitesimal value of the coupling which gives you the gap.
Mm-hmm. That's a nesting right. case. Right?
Yeah, because it's automatically nesting, perfect nesting case. You have no threshold for the coupling. higher dimensions when you need a critical value if you try to generalize it for arbitrary shaped Fermi surface.
I thought he was saying he has his nesting condition.
No, but it's
higher dimensional.
Yeah, that nesting is not, it's not the parallel, it's not by reducing the dimensionality. There are no flat regions on his Fermi surface there, and just using lots of Fermi surfaces which coincide if they translate. Yeah,
so maybe they probably be postponed that, you know, the spin discussion to later on, because, you know, I think I disagree. Yeah. But the statement here is, yeah, it takes an infinitesimal coupling, you're out. Actually, the thing that you should compare this to is to yet another talk that has been given early on in this program, which has been also being discussed in the language of Majorana family. It's a talk by Marcel Franz. So Marcel, you know, discussed a chain of Majoranas, yeah? And he said, well, you know, let me add an interaction term to this Majorana chain, you know, a four Majorana term like, you know, we have done here. And he said, well, you know, takes a finite coupling of that four Majorana term, and it will go into a gapped phase. Yeah, some critical coupling, and that, you know, it's a super conformal field theory, and so on. Yeah. That transition you can cast as a Pyle's transition. Yeah. So really, what happens there is really the same physics as here, yeah, in one dimension. Yeah.
It could be. It could be because you require some key wave type state in the end, and that will require a critical value. But S wave, you know, the usual spin Pyle.
No. This is P wave.
Yeah. Okay. But, okay, I'm still confused, but
maybe. But maybe semantic point is that here there is no phono.
Yeah.
So we don't couple to the phono. There is no elastic energy cost, right?
That's true.
It takes four fermion interaction, right?
Yes,
exactly.
There's no elastic energy cost.
Exactly. So there's no
real distortion of the elastic.
No, but isn't it just like what you're doing is like BCS instability?
Or yes.
There's some logarithmic divergence.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's
level.
Yes, precisely.
Which is also the same as you have for negative U covered models.
So it's an interaction driven BCS instability that drives you into this Pyle space. Yeah. So no phonons whatsoever, but you will have to distort the lattice at the end of the day. Yeah. Because you're required to break, you know, some symmetries, and the way that you can only do this is by doing this. So that you will end up with.
But whether the lattice actually will follow or not will depend on the, you know, how much elastic energy is involved.
That's of course true, but that has been not calculated here. Yeah, this is just a symmetry argument. Yeah, and you know, you have seen a fancy movie, but you know, how much I distort, you know, that will depend all on this interplay with elastic energy. That's true. You know, but also this BCS solution is slightly different from the conventional one. The conventional BCS solution breaks U1 symmetry. There is no U1 symmetry here. What we break is translational symmetry. So, so that's a story of these Majorana Fermi surfaces. Okay, so, and that's their instabilities, this is spin Pyle's instability. It's not the only case where we can get the spin Pyle's instability. So that's what I would like to, you know, discuss in the last, you know, couple of minutes here.
If you have this instability, then you get Fermi lines. So the spectrums change, the meta fermion spectrum is changing.
Yes, yes.
Is this any different from these nodal lines you have without any interactions?
So it's different in the following sense. So here I got only one nodal line. Yeah, while, you know, what I got when I, drove this system into that Pyle phase, I got three nodal lines, which actually cross, so that, you know, they have a very specific signature in a specific heat.
From the crossing point of view, they're similar?
Well, they're similar in the sense that they have nodal lines. Yeah. So, but what's also important is that we go from one spin liquid to another spin liquid. So I'm not going into some singlet phase. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I have a question which is probably really dumb.
Okay, good.
But that's my role here anyways. So the Pyle's instability comes about because you added some additional interaction, right?
Yes.
So if you do that to these other ones that don't show Pyle's instabilities, they all have nodes or whatever where these spectra are crossing. Does that at least, if you do the same thing, does that put some repulsion in there?
No, so nothing happens. So that's, you know, this line. So, you know, so these other lattices, you know, they're not sensitive to doubling the unit cell. So, you know, they're like, why should I do that? Yeah. So, so there's no, from the perspective of these Majorana metals, you know, no gain in that.
Yeah. So you don't, it doesn't modify the spectrum just by having this other.
So, well, of course, it will modify the spectrum in the sense that you have doubled your unit cell, so everything gets folded back. But that's all. Yeah.
So A3B is a wire node.
Yeah.
So you have Pyle's instability.
Yes, let's discuss that case.
Now? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So you see there's three cases where I have this Pyle's instability. Let me first point out the first two. So these two are the ones that correspond precisely to the case where it gets a Fermi surface. So it can only get the Fermi surface If I have a finite K naught, you know, the natural instability of the Fermi surface is this pi instability, doubling of the unit cell. Yeah, so that will happen in these systems. So if you're not in the pure Kitaev model, you know, you have no chance of seeing that Fermi surface. But you turn on, you know, a time reversal symmetry breaking perturbation like a magnetic field, which will deform your Majorana Fermi surface in such a way that this nesting condition goes away, and then actually these surfaces are stable. Yeah. So seeing the Majorana Fermi surfaces is something that you should do in a magnetic field. Okay. Good. So now let's go to the last possibility in this table that there is, and that's, you know, that you get nodal structures. Yeah. So the nodal structure, you know, of course, we know very well from the honeycomb Kitaev model, where the solution was that you get two Dirac cones. Okay. So that's, you know, two-dimensional. Now, in the three-dimensional versions, you know, I can get also, you know, nodal points, but they're not Dirac, but wire nodes. Yeah? And let me first discuss this scenario, where I break time reversal symmetry and I generate a wire node. So let's understand how that works. Yeah? So I break time reversal symmetry. I do this by adding to the Kitaev coupling a magnetic field term, and the magnetic field points it in one direction. That has, you know, several benefits, one of which is that I can recast this Hamiltonian in a spin form like this, so I get this three spin term, which, you know, then resolved on the level of Majorana fermions is still, you know, a hopping Hamiltonian. This trick, you know, of doing this only works if my Voisins are gapped. Yeah? So, and then, you know, the magnetic field strength has to be smaller than the Voisin gap, and that is, you know, what, you know, the statement is. You know, that's the case for these lattices. So here's the example that I just discussed. You know, here's my Majorana Fermi surface. Yeah, but again, now I turn on this magnetic field, different kappas, you know, I can trace, you know, how the Majorana Fermi surface changes, and, you know, well, it deforms, and it immediately loses, you know, this nesting story. So that stabilizes this. So now let's go to another lattice, so the hyper honeycomb. Remember, that's the one that is relevant for the material. Yeah, that had the Fermi line. Now, if you take the Fermi line and you take the magnetic field, what will happen is that you will gap out the Fermi line, but two points. Yeah? So these two points are here. Yeah, so one point up here, another point down here. And these points, you know, turn out to be wire nodes. Yeah? So that's actually quite interesting. So now we have a Majorana system. Yeah, we take the nodal line, we get it out, and we get, you know, these nodes. So here's the spectrum. Yeah. So we start with the spectrum. The colorish one is the one that you have seen, you know, which had, you know, these points, you know, where you know, precisely two, you know, bands cross, and then as you turn on the magnetic field, one of them here will cross out, so that corresponds to a point over here. Yeah, so it will gap out, while this one here, which is this point, now will remain gapless. So you end up with two wire nodes, yeah, which are then described in this, you know, the two bands can give rise to these to this Weyl equation. Okay, very cool. So now we have a Majorana system that does Weyl physics. Okay, good. So how do we know? Yeah, so here's, you know, answering probably one of your questions. I can now go and, you know, I can check, you know, that these things are really Weyl nodes by, you know, checking that they're indeed, you know, source and sinks of the very flux by calculating the Chern number. For instance, in the way that we do this numerically is we walk through the Brillouin zone and we take, you know, these slabs here, and we move the slab through the Brillouin zone, and we calculate on the slab, you know, the Chern number, and then you see, you know, for this green point, for instance, here, the Chern number is zero, but if you move it here between the two Weyl nodes, you know, the Chern number is one. Okay? So that means, you know, that there must be a singular source of very flux, you know, between your sitting, and that gives you this non-zero Chern number.
And it changes continuously.
And it changes continuously. That's a numerical artifact, of course, yeah. So it just, of course, should just jump, you know, as it goes through that point. Yeah. So these two things are red and yellow.
I think if you compute Chern number, even if you do a non-single valued gauge transformation on the block basis, it doesn't matter. But if you can compute this 1D index, you know, let's say inside a line node, you choose a 1D line, compute that YD number, that number will change. So 2D index Chern number doesn't change.
Yeah.
So this is the reason.
Yeah, very good. So, okay, so very good. So we don't have a problem that I agree to that. So here's our non-trivial Chern number. So we have established that we have this Weyl story. So, of course, we know that, you know, there's another thing, and that is, you know, every, you know, Weyl node in the bulk, every pair of Weyl node in the bulk is, you know joined by a surface state, a Fermi arc on the surface. So that's what's plotted here on the right. Yeah? So left is the Brillouin zone, and the evolution of the Weyl nodes as you cramp up the kappa term, so the magnetic field term. So you see a lot of, you know, things happening. You know, originally your two Weyl nodes, which are sitting here and here, they move, you know, they split into three, and they rejoin later on, and, you know, they do some dance here in the Brillouin zone, and that is all traced by, you know, a surface mode, you know, which is a single Fermi arc at the beginning, you know, then it splits, yeah, rejoins, and, you know, splits again. Yeah? So, so we can nicely see all of this. Okay, so that's just a description of what that is. Good. Cool. So, our experimental friend will ask, you know, how can you measure this? Well, you know, I have no good answer to that. One is, you know, if you look at the specific heat, you know, you should, in principle, you know, be able to distinguish two contributions. The Y nodes in the bulk will give you now a T to the cube term, you know, and there will be a surface mode, which will be, you know, linear in temperature because you have an arc on the surface. And, you know, if you're somehow able to, you know, play with, you know, the ratios of your systems, you know, you can probably see these two different contributions to the specific heat. And then there's a thermal Hall effect. So now, because we're in a spin system, yeah, we will have not an electronic Hall effect, but a thermal Hall effect. So if you take a sample and you in a magnetic field, and you heat one side, you know, the temperature will actually, so the heat will actually move and move the car away. So you get the thermal Hall effect, and, you know, the thermal Hall conductance you can pull in directly out of this paper by Leon and Tobias for a superconductor, which is more equivalent to all the things that we have been discussing. Yeah, so the same symmetry class. Okay. Good. So equation, which is actually true only for one, you know, pair of Y nodes, you know, probably Leon can work out what happens if you have a couple of Y nodes. You know, to that's it. Yeah? Good. Now, back to the table. So what I discussed is this situation. Yeah? So I take a nodal line, I break time reversal symmetry, I get two Y nodes. Yeah? But there's also situations, you know, there's one case here which is similar, but there's also two cases here where I get Y nodes already without breaking time reversal symmetry. And I would like to point, you know, your interest, you know, to these situations. Yeah? So, you know, the fact that I get Y nodes arises for very different reasons in these two lattice structures. And that's interesting. So let's take the three, you know, systems that we have. So in the hyper honeycomb, I had to break, you know, time reversal symmetry explicitly, and that gave me that Y nodes. You know, in the language cast of free fermions, that puts me into symmetry class D. That's why I'm, you know, morally equivalent to the wild superconductor of Leon and Tobias. Yeah? So here's lattice 93A, yeah, which is different. What is different? Well, it is the one lattice in this table where the elementary loop has an odd number of bonds. It's not an even number. An odd number of bonds. So for quite general grounds, we know that a Majorana hopping along a loop of an odd number of bonds, you know, has to pick up a phase of plus or minus pi over 2. And you have to make a decision, yeah, whether it's plus 2 over 2 or minus pi over 2. So your system has to break spontaneously time reversal symmetry. So this has to happen as you go into the zero temperature limit of that mod. Okay?
It's not a bipartite lattice.
It's not a bipartite lattice because, you know, the elementary loop length is 9.
Oh, you just said sometimes.
All but one of them are bipartite. Yeah? So this is like the triangle lattice, also non-bipartite lattice, you know, playing around happening on a triangle lattice, you know, are the same sort. So that also puts you in the same circuit at the end of the day. You know, you have broken time reversal symmetry, but you have done so spontaneously. You know, but it actually, you know, puts an interesting question on the finite temperature transition, because potentially these things, you know, happen simultaneously. You know, the gauge field freezes out at the finite temperature, and it breaks spontaneously time reversal symmetry, and that's, you know, certainly not a special, you know, not a standard type of phase solution. The other lattice, and that's one of the lattices that is actually circulating in the plastic model here, is this lattice H3B, where we don't break time-reversal symmetry, and interestingly, also not inversion symmetry. Yeah? So that's a situation that is not allowed in an electronic system. Yeah? So if you remember the talk from yesterday, yeah, statement was made that in an electronic system, you have to break either time-reversal or inversion symmetry to get wild physics. In this situation, you can come away by, you know, without. So why? The reason, again, is that time-reversal symmetry in this system, H3B, is one of these lattices, which a non-trivial sublattice connector K naught, yeah, that actually will, you know, do this job of mapping, you know, the different Y nodes on top of each other. So in this system, you know, we get four Y nodes in the absence of, you know, breaking of either of these symmetries. And that's interesting. It's a symmetry scenario beyond the electronic systems, and in terms of symmetry class classification, that's class BD1. Yeah? So what is that good for? Well, it's probably good for, you know, trying to understand what, for instance, disorder does to these systems. You know? So we know that the symmetry class, you know, plays typically a role in that. And, you know, we see that now we have here two wild systems that are in you know, very different symmetry classes, you know, A and A2, also electronic systems, class D and BD1 here, that, you know, you can study and ask, you know, how, for instance, you know, that is different. So, way over time, so let me stop here. So what have we learned? We have learned that, you know, catalytic models are interesting for the spin fractionalizations. We have played with these models in three spatial dimensions by going, you know, to these different types of lattice structures. What we have concentrated our discussion on today was on the gapless phase in these models. And the gapless phase, you know, depends on very much on the geometry of the lattice. And, you know, can have, you know, Dirac points, Fermi lines, Y nodes, or Fermi surfaces, depending on which structure you're on. And, you know, on top of that, you know, you might get, you know, these spin piles and possibilities that I discussed quite a bit. And with that, I want to finish.
So we asked a lot of questions, but are there more questions? I have one question. So in your table, you didn't discuss, but there's a 10-3C.
Yeah.
That one, when you break tiles, the Y node becomes Fermi surface.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only case where the density of state actually increases by breaking tiles. In the other case,
So let me very quickly explain the physics of that lattice. So that lattice is a friend of 10^3b, the hyper honeycomb. So the hyper honeycomb, you know this very well, is, you know, a three-dimensional lattice where you have two zigzag chains which are 90 degrees to each other and coupled by the third bond.
Right.
So the 10^3c lattice is three zigzag chains which are 120 degrees apart, so three of them 120 degrees apart, coupled by the z bond. That's a lattice. Yeah, and for that reason, it has slightly bigger but what's more interesting, it breaks inversion symmetry. It's chiral lattice.
Mm-hmm.
So the nodal line that you get, if you break time reversal symmetry, would like to form a while node, and it does, but because you don't have inversion symmetry, the while node is not forced to sit on the Fermi energy, but it turns out to be below it.
I see.
Yeah? Okay. And if it's below it, you know what you actually see, you know, so you pull the while nodes under the, you know, you get the Fermi surface. So the Fermi surface that you actually get is an interesting one, because it's a topological one. You know, so it has a Schur number associated with it. You have calculated Schur number running. That's actually a feature that we see in many of these Fermi surfaces.
So density surface does become smaller as you break time at the end of
it. It has to.
Okay. So, if there is no further question, let's thank Simon again.